This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with both authors of the recently published important book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. You want to listen to this because one of the authors, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, is down there at Occupy Wall Street giving people advice on crossing bridges, dotting their I's, protesting, and being where you're not supposed to be.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, reporter Jose Cusos is back in the news. People have probably forgotten, but it was a very important incident years ago. Bring us up to date.
Let's go back about 8 years. April 8th, 2003, the U.S. has been bombing the heck out of Baghdad. They've sent in troops. It's the Iraq illegal, unconstitutional war. And what do? The U.S. kills three journalists who were staying at the Palestine Hotel, a big, modern-looking hotel in the middle of central Baghdad. The U.S. put a tank on a bridge and fired shots directly into the hotel, murdering Jose Cusso and two other journalists. The U.S., of course, claimed some BS mistake or that they thought they were doing something, et cetera. And this Cusso is a Spanish journalist, and the Spanish journalists have been extremely upset about this. In fact, one day they all went into Parliament in Spain, 50 or 100 of them, put their cameras down on the floor of the Parliament and said, "We want justice." Well, eventually, of course, after there was no justice, not even a look at it by the United States, as far as I know, a case was filed in Spain against the U.S. Army, really, but against the individuals who, it was believed, were in the chain of command in the division that not only shot Cusso, but also who ordered him to do the shooting. And amazingly, on the 4th of October of this year, the Spanish court, which has now been investigating this case for a number of years, came out with an order going ahead with the prosecution, not only of the three, but of two of their supervisors. And what the judge says, it's Judge Santiago Pedraz, what he said is, first, that it's not only the three soldiers, but two higher-ranking officials who were being prosecuted. And secondly, that one of the assignments of the division, and that the division that shot Cusso, was, quote, to prevent international media from reporting on the military operations during the taking of Baghdad. And what this reporter who wrote this article says, from Al Jazeera, I think, says that is why they managed to not have us reporting, and that there's no images of the attacks right after that. And this ruling, which is in Spanish, but if you go online, you can find it, it offers a precise account of the events on that day, and that the Pentagon knew clearly where the journalists were staying, and it was clearly intentional. And what's interesting is the Spanish judge didn't just do this abstractly. He took a visit to Iraq, and he went to the very bridge, and he noticed that from the bridge, the tank had an unimpeded view of the balconies of the hotel where Jose Cusso was standing, and you had a good enough vision, you could even see what people were holding on the balcony. So here we have this intentional killing of journalists, and unfortunately and sadly, it's not the first time. Unfortunately and sadly, it appears that the U.S. directly targeted them, and it's all about really suppressing the news and suppressing journalists that they don't like. I just came back from Norway where I saw a film called Death in Camp Delta. It's about a suicide that took place in Camp Delta, according to the United States.
Where's Camp Delta?
In Guantanamo. But it wasn't a suicide. It was almost for sure a killing either because of torture gone wrong or right or a murder by the U.S. But one of the people there was Sami El-Haj, and I don't know if our listeners remember Sami El-Haj. Sami El-Haj is the only reporter who was in Guantanamo, not as a reporter, but as a detainee. He was there for 6 years, and he works in Doha as a Al Jazeera correspondent. So heads the human rights desk, actually, at Al Jazeera. The killing of Jose Cusso in Spain, which is an outrage, unfortunately has a familiar refrain. Michael, I know you and I, of course, did a first book on Che a number of years ago, Che and the FBI, and we've been working on a new book for a long time. And last week was the 44th anniversary of the assassination murder of Che Guevara. And our book is out and published after you and I have done much work on it. Tell us about the book, what it's called, and how you can get it.
The book is called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. October 9th was the 44th anniversary of the murder, or really more precisely an assassination, which is a political murder. The whole operation, as we prove in the book with documents, the documents that you got, you tried to get those documents 17 years ago, Michael, and then you got a bunch of them, then you got some more just 3 years ago. We put it all together and we demonstrate that the assassination of Che was organized right out of the White House. We've got documents on White House stationery. We've got the Army documents, we've got the CIA documents, we've got the State Department documents, and it's clear Che Guevara, representing social revolution, that is when one class, the poorer class, comes to power and dispossesses the richer class, so that's why you don't have any child malnutrition in Cuba, and you've got 7 million children starving, according to a survey at the UN last month. In Latin America, when one class displaces another, that's a social revolution. And that's what the United States tried successfully to stop by training the Bolivian troops that captured Che, by making a pre-arrangement. The CIA guy that came down and met with the Bolivian dictator that the United States had put in power got an agreement from that dictator that if Che was caught by the troops that the United States was training, he would be assassinated. It was a prior agreement. The CIA arranged for the intelligence in Bolivia. They tracked Che down. They captured him, and the next day they had him murdered. And we demonstrate all of that in our book. Plus, the book is a biography of Che, for people who know that he's an icon for social justice and somebody that just didn't talk about it but actually tried to do something about it. So it's a biography of Che, and it's also an indictment of really a counter-revolutionary nature then and now of American foreign policy.
This is Michael Ratner. I want to always identify as, now that was Michael Smith. The book is written by Ratner and Smith. Michael particularly added, in the context of Che's murder, how the U.S. had set up a Green Beret type of force to go down and help track him down. And then after his murder, of course, put out false stories that they wanted him kept alive. Yeah, you believe that like you believe they wanted Bin Laden kept alive, yeah. Or like I wanted al-Awlaki kept alive, or the journalist at the Palestine Hotel kept alive. You yeah. believe that, and I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. Yeah. But anyway, amazingly, most people went along with the story that the U.S. didn't want him killed. And Michael Smith and I, just demolish that. And we do it carefully, painstakingly, but we also give it the broader context of revolution in Latin America. And you also have a chance to see the documents that we based it on. And that's a pretty interesting part of the book, the actual documents.
You can get it at OrBooks, O-R, either or, OrBooks.com. Get it online, OrBooks.com. People that have seen the documents say it's really creepy, you know, when you see it in black and white.
A number of people who've read it have sent us emails and sent Michael an email, really a couple of times, lauding the book and said it's highly readable. It's a great short biography of Che. And it also, once again, shows that targeted assassinations are unfortunately the order of the day in the United States.
In the old days, at least they covered them up, you know. They had the doctrine of plausible deniability, where the president would give the CIA kind of a broad outline on what to do, but he really didn't want to know about it. You know, do it on the QT, guys. But now, as you see with al-Awlaki, they actually brag about it. So this Murder Incorporated, which is the U.S. government, which used to do it quietly, they assassinated or tried to assassinate 17 foreign leaders before they finally were successful in killing Che. Now they openly brag about it.
Right. That's actually an important distinction. I guess you could track that to the decline of empire in a certain way, that now they just say, we're the toughest guys on the block and we're just going to kill you. So that's what they do. Again, the book by Ratner Smith, Smith and Ratner, Who Killed Che? Wait, what's the name of it, Michael?
Yeah, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. OrBooks, O-R, OrBooks.com. Pick up a copy. Stay tuned to us because we're going to be having book launches. The publication date is November 15th. Michael, I had dinner last weekend with attorney Reed Brody from Human Rights Watch, who's the spokesperson for Human Rights Watch in Europe, and he was gleeful about telling about how they stopped Bush from coming to make a speech in Switzerland. And now I understand that Bush is at least attempting to go to Vancouver. Bring us up to date on that one.
That was a Center for Constitutional Rights case we filed in Switzerland. Bush was invited to go to Switzerland, and I think we've mentioned this on the show before, invited to go a few months ago by, of course, some kind of pro-Israel group. And he accepts the invitation. It was going to be his first trip outside of the United States since he is no longer president. And, you know, he was never a great international traveler. But
He never went anywhere before he ran for office, anywhere.
You've got to figure they're probably giving him a fortune for the speech.
Yeah, he needs it.
So the center has prepared an indictment and filed it in Switzerland, an indictment against George Bush for torture. He's an open, admitted torturer. He said he ordered waterboarding and would do it again and again. And so we filed the indictment. And, of course, Bush, I don't think he got across the border in Texas before he said, I'm not going. Because I guess he might have had a real fear that he was going to be clapped into the slammer or at least asked about what's going on while under police in police custody. So that was, I considered, a major success. And there's only, Michael, maybe 158 countries that have the same treaty that Switzerland would have prosecuted Bush under. That's the Convention Against Torture. And what it does is it obligates countries to investigate and prosecute torturers in their territory. And U.S. has it, of course, which is why they haven't done anything, of course. But Canada has it. And, of course, Bush's next little foray out of the country is going to be to Vancouver. Lovely Canada.
Will he make it?
This is a very good question. It's October 20th, so you guys should keep track as you listen to this. But the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with the Canadian Center for International Justice, which worked with us also in the Swiss case, has filed an indictment in Canada, and there's been a huge urging to the prosecutor. You can't go to court yourself in Canada, but to ask the prosecutor to begin the investigation and indictment of George Bush. So the question will be, will he cross the border into Canada, into Vancouver? Well, you know, it's interesting what they're doing. Or will he try and get assurances from the prosecutor first, which I'm sure he will try and do that. Whether they'll give it to him, I don't know. But, you know, they've also been the English.
I was going to say, we should mention that. It's important.
They've been going after this woman, Livni, who is the, what's her party, the Kadima Party. She considers herself a centerist, but in most countries she would be right wing of Attila the Hun, actually. But that's Livni. And they actually had an indictment against her, or at least they were trying to prosecute her in the United Kingdom.
It was for her role in the destruction of Gaza.
That's correct, Michael. She was she was in the government at that time,
yeah.
And was one of the directors of that war. And she wants to go to England, and they were going to, again, try and prosecute her there. Or when I say they, people of Michael Smith's and my ilk were going to go into court in
99%.
And in England, they actually do something because that's where you do Pinochet. Did Pinochet, the Chilean dictator. So Livni was very nervous about it and wouldn't have gone. But then what do, Michael?
Well, they made a special exception. They carved out an exception to what had been an important law. The rule of law has been subverted in England to accommodate these mass killers. You remember, there were 1,100 people, many of them children, killed in Gaza. She should have been brought to justice, but
they carved out
the exception.
They've changed the law to make it more difficult, but she could still be gotten because she did it back in 2008 and 2009. But what they did was even more interesting with her. They gave her diplomatic immunity.
Yeah.
Even though she doesn't represent a government, is not a diplomat, is an opposition party in Israel, they gave her, they said it's very unusual, very rare, they gave her a temporary diplomatic visa.
She got a pass.
And our listeners may not know it, but that's one of the areas that is inviolable, that when you're a diplomat, you essentially can't be brought to
justice.
Well,
you're like standing on the soil of your own country.
Right. And it's considered... You're considered untouchable by the justice system. And so they've given her diplomatic immunity from prosecution for her one-week visit or whatever she's going to spend. So we're getting closer. We're breathing down their necks, Michael. Livni, Bush, you know, we got the soldiers in Spain who murdered the Palestinian journalist. We're moving around here. We're checkerboarding him, and I can't say it's checkmate yet, but we're getting there.
Well, but you see how the rule of law is untangling under this imperialist pressure. Talk about Alawaki, speaking of rule of law, the American who's pledged to defend the Constitution, which includes the Fifth Amendment, due process. You can't deprive somebody of their life without due process, which we've always understood to mean you have to go to court. And nonetheless, they assassinated an American citizen in Yemen, a man named Alawaki. Talk about that.
And now, of course, if you were an American citizen fighting on behalf of the Nazis in the Second World War, you know, they could just shoot you if you were in a uniform sitting on the other side shooting. But the distinction which you're making is one that, of course, American citizen is of significance, but is also that he wasn't in a war. This guy was sitting in Yemen in civilian clothes, just sitting there, and they put him on an assassination list and launch a drone against the guy. And so, yes, the American citizen and the Fifth Amendment protects him, but he's also protected by fundamental laws of humanitarian law, with the laws of war and human rights.
He's also protected because there's a law against the President of the United States ordering an assassination. That's a recent law.
Right.
There's also another law called, you know, it's murderers against the law.
So that's what you have. I know last time you read the op-ed that I wrote on Alawaki, which is in The Guardian, which people can go to our website and get. It was widely read about my opposition and the Center for Constitutional Rights, which brought a lawsuit to try and stop the assassination. And now it's again all over the news. And what's interesting, it's getting more attention in a, quote, somewhat favorable way than I expected. That people are upset by the fact that the administration hasn't really given its reasons for killing him. They come out with some broad BS, and there was a press conference the other day with the president's press guy. Went 4 minutes, and there was one reporter pressing him, well, what's the evidence? What'd you have on him? And the guy he was befuddled. I mean, he didn't know what to say, and they still haven't come out with the evidence. Recently, the Times published part of the memo that the U.S. says would justify his killing from a legal point of view, but only part, so we don't know the whole thing. And then, lo and behold, Michael Smith, who's about to address this issue, the Times writes an editorial about his murder, Alawaki's murder.
If you need further evidence of the hypocrisy of the liberal New York Times, all you got to do is read the editorial in the October 12th issue of the Times. Office of Legal Counsel, you remember, Michael, is the outfit that wrote the famous torture memos. They were asked to justify torture, and they wrote these twisted memos concluding what Bush and the others wanted them to conclude, and that it's legal to torture people. Well, this time, the Times is very happy because, again, the Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the president, took 3 months and wrote a, quote, detailed and cautious memorandum to justify the decision to assassinate Alawaki. So the Times thinks it's good because at least they wrote a detailed memorandum before they killed the man. And here's a conclusion. Mr. Alawaki was not entitled to full protections, but as an American, he was entitled to some. Is that the definition of a liberal trimmer or what?
Which ones? The right to a decent burial?
Yeah.
The right to have somebody scrape up his body parts? What are the ones they're talking about? How about the right to life? The one protection that everybody is entitled to.
The
right
Amendment.
To life.
But, you know,
the Fifth Amendment is there. Yes, you need due process. But I want to emphasize, I think Alawaki should have been protected even if he wasn't a U.S. citizen. I don't like narrowing the law to a U.S. citizen.
I totally agree.
For our litigation in the U.S. court, yes, I have to use the Constitution to protect Alawaki. But in fact, you know, the only time you're allowed to kill people is in a shooting war. And then you have the right to actually shoot people on the other side who are shooting at you or, you know, in a war against you. But short of that, unless someone is about to toss a bomb at you on the street and you have to use force to stop that, you don't have a right to just shoot people.
Well, but the United States justifies this based on the declaration of war in 2001 after 9/11.
So the question for you and I is, if we sat here spouting the stuff that Alawaki spouted and, you know, had some meetings with some people and stuff like that, if he did, would they have the right to drone attack, kill me in New York? And the answer...
Well, that's exactly the question.
The answer under their theory is yes.
Yes, yes, yes. That the country where the person had his feet planted when he was blown sky high is irrelevant. The fact is there's a declaration of war after 9/11. 10 years ago, they made a declaration of war against terrorism, whatever that means. They can go out and kill people. That's what they're basing it on. I'd like to see this legal memorandum.
So if people are interested in the fact that the U.S. can drop drones on almost anyone, on anyone, citizen, non-citizen, wherever they are, Yemen, the United States. We want you to go to www.dronedetector.com, where you can purchase a drone detector. Anyway, Michael and I, we just made that up, but it's you know. Anyway, get your drone detector now.
Well, you know, if you want to learn more about it, go to the center's website, which is, Michael?
CCRjustice.org. CCRjustice.org. We brought a case with the ACLU to try and stop the killing of al-Awlaki. We were thrown out of court. The judge considered it serious, but of course, that's again typical serious, but no relief. It's an executive decision. And of course, the executive made the decision. Obama basically pushed the big red button. Drone, drone, drone.
You know, and this is the guy that was supposed to be an improvement. The pendulum is going to swing back. Obama's going to get elected and civil liberties are going to get better. And so instead of torturing people, he's now assassinating them. This is the liberal definition of better.
I used to think it was cheaper to torture people, but now I realize I was reading an article on drones the other day. Each drone takes 150 people to man it, essentially, you know, to look at all the intelligence, to, you know, press all the right buttons, you know, et cetera. I wonder what you do when you're sitting in, like, wherever they're sitting in Virginia or Nevada, where they press
Nevada,
the button.
Right outside of Las Vegas.
Nevada, is it, you get this picture, you see al-Awlaki, he was getting into a car with another American citizen.
Another American and five others.
Right. Another American citizen, five others. An American citizen who was not on the kill list.
No.
Who was a journalist. I mean, a writer for Al-Qaeda in Arabia, I guess.
Al-Qaeda in Arabia.
Yeah, Al-Qaeda in Arabia. And his magazine was called Inspire. And I guess they see these guys getting into their car, and then they just, like, I push a button when I, like, what do I push a button for on my computer? I push them all the time to, like, open a PDF file. That's what it's like. Boom. Gone.
Well, they get these young kids who are good at video games. I'm not exaggerating. Those are the people they recruit, and they run them out of this office outside of Las Vegas.
Well, now I'm going to tell – now you've led right into the Ender's Game story. Jake, my son, when he was 10 or 11, read a book, a science fiction book called Ender's Game. And it's a famous science fiction book. And, of course, your son, I think,
likes science fiction too.
Also. Ender's Game is a story of these kids. They pick the kids who are the fastest at computers, that are just geniuses at, like, playing computer games. And they train them in what the kids believe is just better, more and more sophisticated games. So, like, spaceships float across the screen, boom, and the kids, you know, hit them, and 80 people get killed, et cetera. And then by the time they're 18 or 22, they're getting slower, and they're moving them off. And only at the very end are the kids told that what you were doing was actually engaging in a real space war with our enemies, and you're actually killing them when you're sitting on the computer. And they did it because kids are that quick and dexterous.
Yeah, and that's precisely what the United States is doing in our name.
So Obama probably didn't push the button because he probably is too old to push the button. They probably have, you know, some child soldiers. They maybe have a child soldier push the button because the U.S., you know, uses child soldiers. It's a pretty sad development in the United States.
Michael Ratner, it's the 10th anniversary of the war against Afghanistan.
That, Michael, as I recall, and you and I both recall, that's the so-called good war, right?
Yeah, well, that's the one that Obama said, we're going to get out of Iraq, we're going to prosecute the good war.
Right. That's the good war. We all thought, because I wasn't, and you didn't think that, and I didn't think that, but after 9/11, that's the war that basically even many liberals and leftists supported. To our credit, you didn't support it, Michael Smith. I, Michael Ratner, didn't support it. Jules Lobel didn't support it. Peter Weiss didn't support it. Howard Zinn didn't support it. The Center for Constitutional Rights didn't support it.
Noam Chomsky didn't support it.
And then there was a long dialogue that took place in the nation because initially Richard Falk, which was a shock to all of us, formerly a Princeton professor and a writer for the nation, wrote a long article calling it a just war. By the time I got to my debate with Richard Falk on Democracy Now!, he'd already changed his mind. It was 3 weeks into the war, and I guess he just couldn't stand seeing the devastation that was happening. And his excuse was, and I love Richard, this is not to say anything about Richard, as you know, he's a wonderful and very radical person on many issues, and Palestine included, but some reason he fell afoul after the shock of 9/11, of the fundamental values that we have held for a long time, which is that this was should not have been a war. It should have been a law enforcement action to try and find the people who did 9/11. And there's articles in The Nation that I wrote in response to Richard and Jules wrote, and Richard and Zinn wrote, et cetera. People can go to The Nation website and find them. Just put in just war, and you'll find the 10 years ago articles that we wrote responding to the idea that somehow this was the good war. What does time tell us about what we said?
Well, these people, I hope, have learned something, because the United States used the same ploy to justify the NATO bombing of Libya. And there were people that got suckered into supporting that, too.
I was outraged by it. But it reminded me of when I was in college, and we'll end on this. I remember reading about this Greek woman in Greek plays. Her name was Cassandra. And her fate was to always to be the prophet or the prophetess who was never believed in her own time. And I guess, Michael Smith, you and I and a lot of other very political people are the Cassandras of our time.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Since 9/11, there's been developed an American-wide strategy to take away the right to mass protest. We've talked about the recently published book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, but today we have both authors of this book in the studio, attorney Michael Ratner, our co-host, and our friend and comrade, Margaret Ratner Kunstler. The authors point out how the rights of free speech in this country have changed since 9/11. They detail the new tactics and guidelines used by law enforcement agents that criminalize dissent, disrupt protests, and label demonstrators terrorists. As more protesters take to the streets, it's an important handbook to have to protect yourself and fellow protesters. We'll also get an update on the Brooklyn Bridge mass arrests and what the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild is doing to protect the rights of the people at Occupy Wall Street. Since 9/11, there's been developed an American-wide strategy to take away the right to mass protest. We've talked about the recently published book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, but today we have both authors of this book in the studio, attorney Michael Ratner, our co-host, and our friend and comrade, Margaret Ratner Kunstler. The authors point out how the rights of free speech in this country have changed since 9/11. They detail the new tactics and guidelines used by law enforcement agents that criminalize dissent, disrupt protests, and label demonstrators terrorists. As more protesters take to the streets, it's an important handbook to have to protect yourself and fellow protesters. We'll also get an update on the Brooklyn Bridge mass arrests and what the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild is doing to protect the rights of the people at Occupy Wall Street.
Margie Ratner, Kunstler, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Now, Margie, as our listeners may or may not know, is co-author with me of Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. And it turns out to be an extremely timely book as we talk about Occupy Wall Street, Occupy other cities, Occupy the United States, and then maybe the world. We don't know. But Margie is an active member of the National Lawyers Guild as well as the author of Hell No. And she has been down at Wall Street almost every day at the Occupy Wall Street, giving lots of advice to people, people who were arrested, protesters, etc. So Margie, give us first a sense. You go down there with a table every day.
It's a wonderfully exciting place to be.
What's the table for?
The table is to give legal advice and really to sign up people who have been arrested so we can make sure that they have lawyers at their return dates. This is a time where we don't know what their return dates are because they weren't put through the system. They were given desk appearance tickets or summonses.
These are people arrested on the bridge.
On the bridge and elsewhere. Over 700. And there are about 90 people who were arrested in other places.
There's 90? Really? Yeah. That's just in New York.
That's
and, of course, there's
in
been
New
arrests
York.
In Boston. There's been arrests in a lot of other cities as
right.
well.
Right. There were recently 100 arrests in Boston.
That's right. Tell us what the mood is first down at Occupy Wall Street. When you set up your table, do people come up? What kind of questions do they ask?
Well, they have very technical questions, and I don't always have the answers to them. I have to get somebody to research them for me. For example, last night they had a screen up, and on that screen they put pictures of what they're having at their meeting so that when people can't hear because there's no microphone, they can at least get a visual image of what's happening at the meeting if they can't hear. But last night the police asked them to take down the screen. They do ask them to take down the screen every night, and every night they put the screen up. And from my experience, they put the screen up at about 7 o'clock. And at about 11 o'clock, the police come and ask them to take it down.
I was there at 10 o'clock. And about 10 after 10, they asked him to take it down. Seth Tobachman was narrating, and they were flashing pictures of his book. And he was narrating Frederick Douglass's great speech about power concedes nothing without a demand. It never will. It never did. And then when he got done, they asked him to take it down.
Right. So there is an interesting standoff with the cops. I mean, in some way, they look at they went out of their way to arrest hundreds of people on the bridge. But when you go down there, like in probably a number of cities, there's cops standing around. And they did allow this little bit of an opening where things actually happened down there. First of all, politically, what do you make of the fact that they have let these people stay in the park? I mean, I'm sitting here saying, why?
Perhaps, Michael, they had an opportunity to do something about it if they did something quickly.
I think they blew it. I think you're right.
I think they blew it.
Yeah.
I think once they there was so much media coverage and so much support and pictures of police brutality that were all over the place, I think at that point they couldn't then close down the park. In Boston, they closed it down much more quickly. It's just like Attica, you know. They should have shut it down on the 7th, but they waited till the 13th, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that there are a number of reasons that I would list, starting with reason number one, Transport Workers Union Local 100. That's the most powerful union in the city. They take people to work. City shuts down if they get angry. And they came out with a great statement supporting Occupy Wall Street. But not just the transport workers. Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. National Nurses United. Industrial Workers of the World. American Federation of State, County, Municipal Workers. AFSCME. Labor's International Union. Amalgamated Transit Union. United Steel Workers. They've done something that we were never able to do when we were active during Vietnam. We could never get the unions to work with us. In fact, they worked against us. And here, you've got some of the strongest unions in the country. So Bloomberg has said you can stay as long as you want. Well, I know the reason why. They're messing with the wrong people now.
So, Margie, you're with the Guild. The Guild has been trying to represent people all across the country, New York and elsewhere. And why don't you give people a sense, first of all, if they have questions or if they get in trouble, what is there a website they can go to find out some information?
Yes. Each major guild office has a hotline. There's a website that recites all of these hotline numbers, and that's at the nlg.org. And that has a subcategory of Occupy, and it lists all of the guild offices and the emergency numbers.
Let's go back to the arrests on the bridge. There were 700 people arrested on the bridge. What happened on the bridge? And what did it remind you, you know, you've written in Hell No about what happened to dissent in this country, what happened really from Seattle forward, including the Republican National Convention in New York, the one in Minneapolis, and other places. Was there anything on the bridge that was reminiscent of how you say dissent is being suppressed in the country?
Yes, they had decided to arrest people on the bridge, and they had decided in an interesting fashion. They actually led people down to the bridge walkway. There's a law in New York that says you cannot block roadways, but you can march on sidewalks. They led people down to the roadway, then announced with a bullhorn that not everybody could hear of the 800 people on the bridge, more than 800 people on the bridge, that you are now in doing something illegal, you must disperse immediately or we're going to arrest you. Well, most people were chanting, and if you look at the YouTube video of it, you can see how nobody could hear that announcement. And everybody, I've been speaking to a lot of witnesses to it, and they say that the police took the people down to the roadway. Now, why do this? There was no place to put these 800 people.
No place meaning once they arrest them.
Once they arrested them, they had no facilities. They hadn't set up the court system to deal with them. Why do it? To get their names, to get their pedigree information, to do intelligence.
I think that's a brilliant. That's really, you know, I hadn't thought of that. I was interested that they gave them desk appearance tickets because the last time in New York, which you were very involved in, when they arrested people at the Republican National Convention in 2004, same way with a big plastic net, just herded people in. They kept those people at what you referred to and others as Guantanamo on the Hudson for 3 or 4 days. You brought lawsuits. But those people they kept because they wanted them off the streets. But these people, they obviously, yeah, they wanted them off the streets for a few hours, but they let them out.
Early on, with the RNC arrest, they had a sheet of paper that asked people what political affiliations they had. Well, we stopped that quickly. But the police department in New York City has a tremendous intelligence division. The inspectors at the intelligence division do nothing but sit and figure out how they can gather information about people. They have machines that can tell if there's radiation that are set off by people who are walking down the street who happen to have cancer. And they set off these machines. They have spent an absolute fortune on this. They have duplicated the FBI and CIA activities and are spending unheard of amounts of money on these activities.
So they arrest these people, and they do it again. Say the purpose for the arrest.
The purpose for the arrest is to get the names and pedigree information on these people so that they know who are the demonstrators and who to watch out for.
J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, the two banks have come together, and they gave the New York City Police Department $4.6 million.
Well, they need the protection, obviously.
They don't pay taxes, but they give the police the money directly.
Right.
So that's those arrests. Now, tell us what's been going on other arrests around, particularly New York, in Occupy Wall Street. You said there were 90 other arrests. How did that happen?
Those are people who jumped over barricades. Some people, we have no idea why they're arrested. A young woman yesterday morning was arrested. She was chalking on the sidewalk, and she chalked out, good morning, New York PD. And she was arrested. Not only was she arrested, but the people who were photographing her arrest were also arrested.
Unbelievable.
So it's that type of arrest as well.
So again, for people who need information, nationallawyersguild.org, NLG.org, lots of hotline numbers on there. The Guild is all over the country. They're everywhere. They're giving advice. They're doing what they have done for half a century, helping people avoid the cops. And if they get involved with the cops, telling them what to do. Michael?
Margie, in your book, you give a history of the bad stuff that's come down. Not like it was great before, but since 9/11, it's been really bad. Talk about what you think the most important points you're trying to make in the book.
Well, actually, it started after Seattle, and it was before 9/11. Much of the planning for how to stop demonstrators happened right after Seattle.
Seattle was World Trade Organization.
Yes.
So I think what's interesting, and I was going to say the same thing to Michael, what Margie starts in the book with, and she really wrote this part of the book, 1999 Seattle.
Yeah.
And if you look at where most of it comes down,
yeah,
some's Republican National Convention and stuff, but a lot of it's around world finance capital.
Yeah.
World Trade Organization, GA, G20. That's the way I read what you wrote.
Absolutely.
Here.
And there was, at that point, there was this training program that began with all of these local police forces across the country and the FBI. And that's when they started with their intelligence gathering groups and their joint operations and figured out tactics to deal with demonstrators to prevent the demonstrating. It wasn't until 9/11 that they were fully funded. So you have a change there because the funding came down after 9/11. But the planning started in 1999.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When Michael and I wrote this, we were totally depressed because we figured the demonstrations were over. There were so many ways of preventing demonstrations, and people were penned, and people weren't given permits, and people were frightened by the ninja costumes, and people were frightened by the nets. And we figured, oh, no one's ever going to demonstrate anymore. They're just going to be locked up, and they're going to be kept off the streets.
I mean, there seems to be a lot of support from them outside of the normal, like you would say, the normal, what we would have called you and I and Michael, the old left and the left. You know, the slogan is incredible, 99 and 1%. You know, the 1% is incredible because that says it all. You don't need demands after that. That's a demand.
You know what that does? That cuts across all the BS about how we're all middle class. You know, nonsense. There's a ruling class. It's the 1%, and we're the rest of them. People understand that.
How do you see the level of support for Occupy Wall Street? You're there a lot.
The level of support is wonderful. I mean, it's the best example of that is the food table. People from Europe, people all over the world, call up pizzerias to deliver food to Occupy Wall Street.
I saw a stack that must have been 8 feet high 2 days ago.
They've been ordering from our favorite deli, Michael, Katz's Delicatessen.
Really?
Those delicious pastrami
They're
sandwiches.
Pastrami sandwiches?
They are.
You know, that started in Madison. People in Madison, when they were rebelling against Governor Walker and his attempt to crush the unions, they were saying, walk like an Egyptian. And so the Egyptians started sending pizzas to the demonstrators in Madison.
So, Margie, you sit at that table there, and people come up to you. Some of it is the big advice, like on where they can run a screen, but there's a lot of individual questions, right? What kind of advice? What kind of questions?
Questions are, what kind of trouble can they get into for filming an arrest? What if they record an arrest?
So let's stay to that first.
Okay.
Let's say I see an arrest happening. We've covered this a little bit, but in New York, can I film an arrest?
You certainly can. Police don't like it, and they might take your camera or your phone, but the law says you can. Now, that's what I keep telling people. I said, the law may be on your side, but the police don't necessarily follow the law.
Okay, but that's one good point, that people everywhere ought to be filming any kind of arrest.
Absolutely.
Okay, and you said that maybe you were leading to a second point also.
The second point is, can they record the police? And in New York
City, record by sound.
By sound. And in New York, we have a one-party recording possibility. So in other states, I don't...
But when I do a video, it's automatically taking the sound.
Yes, but if you're just doing sound, there's a wiretap restriction. Uh-huh. If you're recording and only one party knows that you're recording, that's okay in New York. In Massachusetts, for example, both parties have to know that there's a recording happening.
So what if I'm recording the cop and I say, I'm recording you? That's
well,
okay?
That would be okay. We don't have to say that in New York, but you should. No, you need his permission.
Boston. You need a permission. Yeah. I think, and that's true in Maryland also. Yeah. There's a few states that require that. It's interesting. Even if he sees the recorder, if he sees the tape recorder, then you could argue that he gave his permission because he didn't stop.
Absolutely. Okay, record him.
Okay,
anyway.
So that's two of the questions you got are about photographing the cops, recording them, videoing. What kind of other things do you get?
When can police officers use extraordinary force, such as mace and their batons.
Or pepper spray, which we saw them use against those three women. So what do you say about pepper spray or mace or whatever they call that stuff?
Well, you know, they're not supposed to use it unless that some kind of force is used against them or there's a threat. But once again, the police don't necessarily obey those laws. And there's really no opportunity to enforce those laws, so people are told to be careful.
Now, I have a huge can of bear spray, which is pepper spray, that I bought when I went out to Yellowstone a few weeks ago. And can I bring that down there? And if there's problems, you know, pepper spray the cops?
I think you might get arrested for that, Michael.
Am I allowed to even have pepper spray in New York, a big can like that? They do. I think it might be legal to buy for protection.
Well, you can use it in self-defense.
Yeah, I think
you can. Assault
is okay, so that's pepper spray. Now, do people ever ask questions about if a cop asks for your identification? You're walking down the street. The cop says, stop. He sees you're going up to this demonstration. You're going to another demonstration. Can he stop you and say, give me your ID?
No, he cannot.
They're allowed.
But does he? Yes.
Can he
and
search you?
And if you're
you?
Black, he certainly does.
Can he search you?
No, he cannot.
But if you're black?
He does.
Or Latino?
Yes.
In New York?
If he asks you who you are, do you have to tell him?
If you're stopped and he has a reasonable basis to ask you that question, you have to answer it.
That's the one question.
The one question is your name.
But no more.
Your address, perhaps, but nothing other than that.
And after that, you ought to say you're represented by the National Lawyers Guild and have them call the National Lawyers Guild.
And what's Absolutely. That website again?
NLG.org.
What's going to happen on all these arrests, the Brooklyn Bridge arrests, for example? What do you think is going to happen to everybody?
I think they're going to be dismissed.
Because it's a bad arrest,
because
right?
Because it's a bad arrest.
I was getting calls. I told you, Marge and I talked during the period. I was getting calls from people in the middle of the crowd, in the back of the crowd, saying, what, we're going to be arrested? I mean, these are like young people, friends of our children. And they said, we just walked on the bridge with everybody else. We never heard a warning. We're never told anything. And they do have to give you a warning. They have to say, leave the bridge.
Well, they have to tell you that you're violating a law if right. they've led you there to right. entrap you. You would right. assume that then mm-hmm. they would have to say, oops, we made a mistake. You're not allowed to be here.
I was at the labor demonstration last week, the 30,000 people that gathered in Foley Square. That was really exhilarating, too. I got tired of walking, so I just wanted to stand on the edge of the sidewalk and kind of lean up against a post. And a couple cops came over to me, and they say, you can't stand. You have to walk.
Is that
I
true?
I said, I'm on the sidewalk. I never heard of a law like that. I'm not moving. So then they walked away. Another cop came and said, you got to move. I said, I'm not moving. My back hurts. I'm staying here. I'm on the sidewalk. I got to write. Was I right?
You were right. There are certain sidewalk rules. If you're in a large crowd, you're supposed to be moving, and you can only take up 50% of the sidewalk.
Right. You can't block the sidewalk.
You can't block traffic.
Let's say you're a large crowd. The rule that I normally know is you don't need a permit. As long as you stay on the sidewalk and you keep moving and don't block more than 50%.
That's correct.
But if that large crowd stops, and even if it's only blocking 50%, then it needs a permit, right?
That's correct. It's the old labor picket line rule.
Let's say a cop comes up to you and you take out your pencil and paper and record his badge number. One, are you allowed to do that? Secondly, what's going to happen if you do it? And thirdly, related, does the cop have to give you his name?
The cop doesn't have to give you his name. The cop doesn't have to give you his badge number.
But he has to wear a badge.
He has to wear a badge. And if you ask a cop for his badge number, he'll give you the wrong number. So take the number off the badge.
If he hasn't put it in his pocket.
Attorney pennies made out of, Michael?
Dirty copper.
Okay.
Attorney Margaret Ratner, Kunstler, you co-authored this very important book that everybody should own. This is a manual for all activists. Hell no. Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. I want to ask you, how do you get a hold of this book?
It's available from the New Press.
So New
And you can wire the New Press at newpress.com.
Wire? You do?
The New Press, one word, thenewpress.com. If you had your druthers, where would you like to see this Occupy Wall Street movement go?
I'd like it to be able to last through the winter, that's for sure. I'm worried about these children in the cold. But I'm confident that it's going to be in many other cities across this country that have more clement weather, and that it will continue, and the National Lawyers Guild will be there to support it.
Bloomberg was finally forced to say, you can stay here as long as you want.
Amazing. We'll see what happens. You know, the interesting thing also about this is the democracy. This is really grassroots democracy. I mean, every decision is painfully taken over many hours, and there's committees, and anybody can join any committee, the legal committee, the Constitution Committee, the Food Committee.
The Cleanup Committee, the Food Committee. Right. There's a committee for everything. There are 14 different committees, I think.
And the place is spotless.
Yes.
It's cleaner than it was when the city kept it or ever
organized.
Kept it.
Everything is neat and in place. Today it's kind of raining out there, so there's tarps over everything. All electronic equipment is protected. They're still serving food. It's just amazing.
Well, let's just say
the kind of creativity and energy that people have when it's unleashed. You know, it reminds me of the Russian Revolution.
It is a hard physical existence there, though. I mean, last week or week before, there were lots of rain, and they don't allow tents in the park. And people just, and they have their sleeping bags down with little tarps over them. Yeah. I came down there one morning at 8. It was, you know, it was just like a wet, soggy sponge, the place, and everybody was soaked. So it's not so easy. These people are.
No, it's a tough thing. They're coming in from all over the country to participate. So it's very kind of amorphous and fluid, but, you know, pulsating. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Anybody has a chance, they should come down to Occupy Wall Street. Liberty Park, it's called. It used to be called Zuccotti Park. They changed the name. And even the merchants are going along with it. I heard that McDonald's is allowing people to use their restroom, although Burger King's not. Trinity Church, St. Paul's Chapel, is right near there. They've welcomed the people.
Marjorie, let me ask you about demands, because there are no, quote, demands officially. There's no real leaders to a large extent. But there is the 99 and 1, and it looks pretty much like this is about wealth and banks and all of that. What's your perspective on that? Where's it going to go in that? Is it just going to simply be this? Not simply, it's a huge thing. 99-1, and just say, you better do something about this? Is that the ultimate?
The demand for some kind of justice and equality is the basic demand of all people all over the world. So how can we say that this is too abstract for us? Isn't that what we all want?
I see all these people, and I saw there was a letter today that said, oh, they should do this about the bankruptcy law and do this about, which is all correct, but the demand from a group like this ought to just be 1%, 99%. That's us. And you have to start remedying that. And that's really the driven demand.
Well, you know, I think that it's just not going to go away. The housing crisis, the education crisis, people are taking out $100,000 loans. 18% of the people are unemployed or underemployed. I mean, these are fixtures now. It's not going to go away, and this demonstration is not going to go away. It's only going to grow. And I think that they'll develop more precise demands along the way.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
sounds return pure and easy.